Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. As this afternoon, December 9th, 2020, we have a Courthouse Steps oral argument Teleforum on two cases, Republic of Hungary v. Simon and Federal Republic of Germany v. Philip. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on the call today are those of our experts. We're very fortunate to have with us today two experts. First is Professor Alberto Cole. He's Vincent DePaul Professor of Law and Director of Global Engagement at the DePaul College of Law. We're joined by our moderator for this afternoon's discussion, James C. Dunlop. He's a senior attorney at Sensient Technologies Corporation. So Jim is going to lead a bit of a moderated discussion, and then about halfway through the hour, we'll open up the floor for audience questions. So be thinking of those as we go along and have them in mind for when we get to that portion of the call. Right, without much more delay, Mr. Dunlop, thanks for being with us. I'll hand the floor off to you.
Thank you, Nick, and thank you, Alberto. I'm delighted that we're able to speak with you today. I know you've done a lot of thinking and work in your career on the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. I should also add, in addition to what Nick said, that Alberto and I speak. These are our opinions and our questions, and only ours, not for either of our organizations, DePaul or Sensient. So we find ourselves today considering two cases that were argued this week on Monday in the Supreme Court, Republic of Hungary versus Simon and Federal Republic of Germany versus Philip, both arising under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and posing really interesting and enduring issues in matters of interesting and enduring importance, the disposition, the taking and the ruinous taking of property from Jewish persons in Germany and in Hungary during the Second World War. These may be examples of hard cases making bad law. We'll talk with Professor Cole about that. But they are certainly enduring and posed a lot of issues for the court about when the immunity of sovereign nations should be abrogated under a statute in the United States known as the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, a statute really unique throughout the world. So, Professor Cole, perhaps I can begin just by asking you to tell us about the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and what it is and why it's at the heart of these cases.
Sure. Good morning, Jim. First of all, good morning to you. Good noon to all our listeners over on the East Coast of the United States. It's always a great honor and a great delight to join my fellow members of the Federalist Society in discussing these major issues touching on United States foreign relations law, national security, and foreign policy. And I'm particularly honored and delighted to have Jim Dunlop, a very international attorney, experienced in international matters, joining me on this call. The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act was passed by Congress in 1976 for the purpose of regulating the matter of when foreign sovereigns can be sued before U.S. courts. And the problem was that before the act was passed, for decades, the United States had been in this very difficult situation in which foreign sovereigns would be sued in U.S. courts. And U.S. courts wound up turning to the State Department for guidance, or the State Department would intrude into the proceedings of the U.S. courts, offering their guidance as to whether or not these foreign sovereigns should be immune or not. And so finally, Congress passed the law. The key principle of the law is that the determination of whether immunity applies to a foreign sovereign is a matter for the judiciary to determine. It is not a matter for the executive branch to determine. Okay? So that's the first principle. The second principle is that, as a general rule, there is a presumption of immunity unless certain exceptions apply. Okay? And those exceptions are still carved within the overall framework of the theory of restrictive immunity. The idea that, again, immunity holds unless one of these exceptions applies. Here, in both of these cases, the exception that is at issue is one in the 28 U.S. Code, Section 1605, involving rights in property taken in violation of international law. That is, foreign states shall not be immune from the jurisdiction of the courts of the United States in any case in which rights in property taken in violation of international law are in issue. Okay? And that's really at the heart of both of these cases. What is the meaning of rights in property taken in violation of international law? Okay? Since 1976, of course, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act has been the subject of many, many lawsuits in the United States. The United States Supreme Court has had various opportunities to rule on various aspects of it. These cases posed some very, very interesting questions. And so if I may, Jim, would you like me to just briefly address the issues both posed by each of the two cases?
I think yes, but I think first perhaps just a little background, factual background for each of the cases. The Philip case dealing with stolen artworks, the other, the Hungarian case dealing with the deprivation of property among hundreds of thousands of Hungarians who were deported to death camps.
Yes, exactly. So you know, both of these cases, of course, involved events that took place in the 1930s and 1940s surrounding the Holocaust, okay? So in Germany versus Philip, what we have here is a very famous collection of reliquaries that used to belong to the Duke of Brunswick. The Duke of Brunswick in 1929, before the Great Crash, sold the collection to a consortium of art dealers in Germany, almost all of whom were Jewish. The art dealers sold a number of the objects subsequent. And then in 1935, Hermann Göring engaged in negotiations with this consortium to acquire that property, to acquire the remaining objects in the collection. Okay. The transaction has been described by the plaintiffs as a forced sale. At the time, they claimed that at the time they sold this collection at only 35% of its actual value. Of course, keep in mind this was now in the depths of the Great Depression. And the collection at that time fetched the consortium, you know, the equivalent of several million dollars. Okay. At the end of, and of course, Hermann Göring presented this collection to Adolf Hitler as a personal gift. The collection was seen at the time as a symbol of Germanic power. You know, this was the Guelph collection, the ancient imperial German dynasty that had challenged the power of the papacy in the Middle Ages. And so independently of the Nazis, this collection had a great nationalistic iconographic value for many German nationalists as a symbol of the early German empire's assertion of its sovereignty against the papacy in the Middle Ages. So at the end of the war, the collection wound up in the hands of the German government, which turned it over to a German government foundation, the Prussian Cultural Heritage Foundation. And it has been exhibited in the Berlin Bodleian Museum since then. Okay? The claimants argue that this was a forced sale and that it was a genocidal taking, that this was not simply an expropriation, it was not simply a property taking, it amounted to a genocidal taking. And that therefore, this was not just a right and property taken in violation of international law in the terms of expropriation, but rights and property taken in the middle of, in the course of a genocide. Okay? The claimants tried to get a resolution of this issue, you know, the heirs of the consortium. All of the members of the consortium fled Germany, except for one who was subsequently, there's a controversy whether he was murdered or whether he died of a heart attack. Okay, but their heirs sued in U.S. court. Okay, and they sued in the District of Columbia. They sued both Germany and they also sued the SPK, the Prussian Cultural Foundation. And the district court, in response to Germany and the SPK's motion to dismiss, denied that motion. And it held that the claims fell within the scope of the expropriation exception as a genocidal taking. Okay. And the DC Circuit affirmed, arguing that a genocidal taking is a violation of international law, and that even though this involved property taken from individuals who at the time were German nationals, nevertheless falls within the jurisdictional ambit of the FSIA. The question before the Supreme Court is whether, in this case, whether, number one, the expropriation exception of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act provides jurisdiction over claims that a foreign sovereign has violated international human rights law when taking property from its own national within its own borders. And then secondly, Germany argued that the doctrine of international comity here precludes the exercise of jurisdiction, that this is something that should be resolved in Germany, and that even though there were preliminary proceedings by the claimants in Germany before a commission, which ruled against them, that the claimants still have not gone through the German courts. And that really this is a matter, as a matter of international comity, this issue should be resolved in Germany first. Okay? So that's the case of Germany versus Phillips. Then we move on to the other case, which is Simon versus the Republic of Hungary. Okay? Here you have a number of Jewish persons, four of whom are citizens of the United States, several of whom are persons of other nationalities who live in other countries, such as Canada, Israel, Australia, and others. And the defendant is, of course, Hungary. When they came before the district court, also in D.C., the district court dismissed their claims. And they said that there was no jurisdiction because of the 1947 Treaty of Peace between the United States and Hungary, which does have a clause providing for the resolution by Hungary of Holocaust claims. Interestingly enough, one aspect of this case is that the claimants never have tried resolution of their claims in Hungary, in Hungarian courts or in any kind of Hungarian institution. So the district court said, look, the Treaty of Peace precludes jurisdiction because, after all, the FSIA does provide that, subject to existing international agreements to which the United States is a party at the time of enactment of the act, a foreign state shall be immune from the jurisdiction of the courts unless certain exceptions apply. But there's that clause referring to existing international agreements, and the district court said the Treaty of Peace provides that this is a matter for Hungary to resolve. Okay? The District Court of Appeals took the case and then remanded it back to the district court. And it said that the Treaty of Peace was not an exclusive mechanism for resolving Holocaust claims. and that the district court had the obligation to find out and to allow the claimants to amend their complaint so as to explain why the courts of the United States should have jurisdiction. Okay? So on remand, the district court again dismissed the claims on two grounds. And they said, number one, there is forum nonconvenience. This is, number one, only a few of the claimants are U.S. citizens. Others are from other foreign countries. And it is just as easy for them to travel to Hungary as it is for them to travel to the United States. And most of the relevant records are in Hungary. And this is something that, therefore, would be best for Hungarian courts to decide. And, of course, you know, the claimants are saying, well, the U.S. Holocaust Museum has a lot of records. But the district court argued that most of the relevant records, in fact, were in Hungary. Okay? So there's a doctrine of foreign nonconvenience. And then the district court also said comity, on the basis of international comity, this should be presented before the Hungarian courts first, particularly because the claimants have not exhausted any kinds of domestic remedies. So they're basically coming into U.S. court without having gone to Hungarian courts first. The Court of Appeals, again, overruled the district court and remanded. Okay? And then this was appealed to the United States Supreme Court. Okay? And that's where, you know, the court heard oral arguments for both cases, Dave, this past Monday.
And so, Professor Cole, is it fair to say that as these arrived from the D.C. Circuit in the Supreme Court,
yes,
they essentially both presented the same questions, with really the Phillips case being the lead case on the question of whether a taking of property by a sovereign from its own nationals meets the taking of property under international law exception to foreign sovereign immunity in the United States.
Yes.
And the Hungarian case, the Hungary case, taking the lead on the question of international comity and the doctrine of comity and whether, even if there were jurisdiction, a U.S. court should abstain.
Exactly. It should on the grounds of comity. Okay. And exactly. Those are the two issues posed by these cases. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So let's move to the argument as it unfolded in the court. This is a courthouse steps teleform. And so we really like to give people the sense of the warp and weft of what went on Monday in front of the nine justices. Maybe start with the Phillip case.
Yeah. So, okay. So some of the issues that came up, and I have to say, you know, every one of the justices asked a probing question of both counsel, you know, of counsel on both sides. So a number of the issues that came up were, number one, this whole notion of what rights in property taken in violation of international law means, okay? And, of course, one side argued that it means expropriation. It means property taken by a state from foreign nationals. And that this was the meaning. This was the meaning of the FSIA when it was passed in 1976. And that this language has not been altered by Congress. And that to import into it notions of international human rights law is something that goes beyond what Congress explicitly says in the statute, okay? And that the statute should be interpreted narrowly because the statute touches on important U.S. foreign relations interests. And in situations such as that, courts want to interpret the statutes narrowly so as not to create problems for the executive branch in accordance with separation of powers. And that if Congress really wants to expand the meaning of the statute to include human rights related property takings, then the statute should be amended by Congress accordingly. Okay. Another issue that came up here was the issue that no other countries in the world have made space within their legal systems for claims against foreign countries by their own citizens, okay? And that the United States really stands out on this. And again, if Congress really wants to do this, Congress is free to do that, but that is not what it did with this very narrow language in the FSIA. Justices, both Justice Barrett and Justice Breyer, so, you know, on opposite ends of the ideological spectrum, you know, raised the issue of, you know, as you know, Justice Barrett put 700 federal judges sitting on judgment on all the nations of the world. And Justice Breyer bringing up some very interesting hypotheticals of what would happen with individuals from all over the world bringing into U.S. courts cases against foreign governments involving property takings related to human rights violations. Okay. So that was those were two big issues in the Germany case. Okay. Regarding Hungary versus Simon, okay, the justices spent quite a bit of time dealing with the issue of what is comity. You know, what is comity? How is it different from foreign nonconvenience or act of state? The claimants in the Hungary case argue that the FSIA has displaced the idea of comity. That there's no room for comity, basically, okay? Unless, paradoxically enough, the executive branch were to step in, the State Department, and say, this is not something that would be in the interest of the United States for the courts to determine on, which, of course, you know, flies in the face of the very purpose of the FSIA. But the justices spent quite a bit of time probing the issue of comity. Hungary argues that comity is a common law concept that was not displaced by the FSIA, that the FSIA is basically a pass-through statute, and it leaves untouched notions of, foreign nonconvenience, comity, and even exhaustion of domestic remedies if the court determines that this is appropriate to apply in that particular case. And that comity involves the dignitary interests of foreign states, which may be involved in particular cases much more than in others. Interestingly, also, one of the justices, Justice Alito, asked the question of whether the plaintiffs, if they went to the Hungarian courts and they fail there, they could go to a higher court. And plaintiffs' counsel had to admit that, yes, they could go to the European Court of Human Rights, you know, that provides, because Hungary is part of the Council of Europe, part of the European Convention of Human Rights. So they would have also an opportunity for a remedy at the level of the European Court of Human Rights. Okay. Another red flag that came up in the oral arguments was the issue of reciprocity. You know, would the U.S. be opening itself up to thousands of lawsuits all over the world in other countries' courts under the principle advocated by Simon? Okay. And also the problem that it would be easier for foreign plaintiffs to sue foreign sovereigns in U.S. courts than it would be for foreign plaintiffs to sue foreign private defendants in U.S. courts if you reject the application of a foreign nonconvenience and comity here. You know, the issue of potential severe international friction came up. And then, of course, you know, the plaintiffs kept pushing on the issue that the United States government repeatedly has said that it is a very important foreign policy interest of the United States to resolve Holocaust claims in a fair manner, and that therefore the U.S. courts should not abstain from looking into these cases. So
Well, in fact, Professor Cole, isn't there an amendment, a later amendment to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that deals with Holocaust claims that the parties argued bears on both questions of whether the taking of property by a sovereign from its own nationals meets the taken in violation of international law test, where the violation of international law is genocide, and also on the question of comity, the Holocaust exception to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act?
Not really. I mean, in 2016, the Congress passed what's known as the Clarification Act, you know, which applied to, which said that for purposes of Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, art objects that are on temporary exhibition in the United States, okay, do not qualify as property in the United States, okay, for purposes of the act. And then Congress added, but that exception has an exception, and that is art stolen by the Nazis, confiscated by the Nazis, okay? So obviously, you know, plaintiffs argue that this shows that Congress does not want, you know, art objects to be exempt here from the FSIA's jurisdiction. But Hungary and Germany both argue that this only applies to art objects in the United States that are here on art exhibition, and that was very clearly what this Clarification Act was about. It doesn't go beyond that. So you could see how, you know, both sides could look at that 2016 so-called clarification amendment in different ways.
So on the question of whether the types of takings described in both of these cases on their hard facts meet the exception to foreign sovereign immunity under the Act, which is a taking in violation of international law, I believe it was Justice Kagan who made what I'll call the Scalia argument, which is, why don't we just look at the, or ask the question rather, why don't we just look at the plain meaning of the statute and the plain wording of the statute, which says taken in violation of international law. All the parties recognized and understood that and admitted that genocide violates international law. These takings were generally agreed upon with some factual quibbles to have been in furtherance of genocide as it is defined, in furtherance of a plan to exterminate a population and to bring about the conditions of life that would do that. Why isn't that enough? Why doesn't that end the argument? I think it's the question Justice Kagan asked.
Well, you know, as you follow the oral arguments and the questions the justices posed, the problem is that, you know, the plain text does not end the matter because, number one, plain text is also interpreted in the light of when it was written, what it meant when it was written. Okay. And in 1976, you know, the United States, you know, was not even a party to the Genocide Convention. I mean, genocide was recognized as a customary international law violation, but we were not a party to the Genocide Convention. The Torture Convention did not even exist. So, in fact, it's questionable as to whether torture was considered a violation of international law at the time. And so, looking at the context of when this was written, I think what one has in mind is more the kinds of property takings that had gone on in the 1960s and early 70s in the Eastern Bloc, in the Soviet Union, in the 40s and 50s after World War II, in Cuba, in many Latin American countries. And these were takings of property involving the taking of the property of foreign nationals without compensation. So you also, you know, this would have to be the context.
There had been consistent decisions denying jurisdiction over those takings as a matter of the active state doctrine, for example, the Sabatino case.
Yes, and then you had the Congress pass the second Hickenlooper Amendment saying, no, in these kinds of cases, we want you to exercise, jurisdiction, okay? So there's really no notion here that human rights-related takings were intended to be covered by this, partly because, I mean, you could see the tremendous doors that this would open in terms of litigation, which in fact the court over the past few years has been pushing against. So, the court has cut way back on the alien tort statute by insisting, for example, on the presumption against extraterritoriality. And the idea that, U.S. courts should not be hearing human rights claims, by foreign nationals against foreign states or entities over things that happen overseas, okay? So to say that, this doesn't apply to rights and property when the property was located in a foreign country, and in the case of Germany particularly, what the plaintiffs showed rather convincingly is that these persons, the members of the consortium, were still considered German nationals in 1935. And that this might be considered a forced sale, but to call it a genocidal taking would be a step too far in that particular case. Now, in the case of Hungary, yes, it definitely would have been a genocidal taking because you're talking about Jewish persons that are literally stripped of their property as they are boarded into the trains that are taking them to the death camps, in 1944. And there, of course, the issue is, but isn't there room here for comedy? Isn't there room here for foreign nonconvenience when they have not exhausted domestic remedies? They have not gone through the Hungarian courts, much less to the European Court of Human Rights. Those are the kinds of questions that would come up as a qualification of just, reading, the plain words of, rights and property taken in violation of international law. And I think that's the dilemma the court has on its hands. I mean, if they choose to go down the road you suggest, Jim, and read rights taken, property taken in violation of international law as meaning rights and property, even in these circumstances, taken in violation of international human rights law in the process of human rights violations, then they're going to have to wrestle with the consequences for 700 district judges sitting in judgment over the human rights acts of hundreds of countries around the world in thousands of different kinds of situations. So that's the price they'll have to pay if they want to go down the road of just the pure textual plain meaning of the statute, as opposed to looking at the whole context in which the statute was written.
A point reiterated, I think, several times by Justice Breyer during the argument. So we have canonical conflict between narrowly interpreting a statute. I take it you think that's the appropriate canon, particularly in a case that implicates foreign policy, versus plain reading of the statute. And the plain reading of the statute, you can look at it, seems to me, and I'd like you to comment on this, either it's a broad way of doing this that in light of the context it imports too much, or is a narrow way of doing it, which, I think there was a citation to Justice Scalia on this in one of the briefs, that what you do when you look at the plain text in this case is you don't assume that simply because Congress was cognizant of expropriation issues in communist countries at the time that it passed the statute, that its choice of more general wording to do that, magically imports that limitation that it didn't expressly apply.
Well, so, bringing Justice Scalia into the discussion, Justice Scalia has a very strong opinion in the Hartford case on comedy, okay, where he really, you know, he really disagrees with the approach taken by the court's majority in that case. And he talks about the importance of international comedy, and he emphasizes, and this is why I think that this statute needs to be read narrowly, because if you believe in separation of powers and you believe that questions of foreign policy are the preserve of executive power, you know, unless Congress very specifically gives them to the courts to do, then what you have here is a way of reading the statute narrowly and also allowing for the common law principle of comedy in situations such as this one, in that case of Hungary, where you haven't had recourse by the plaintiffs to the domestic legal system, and much less to the regional legal system provided by the European Convention of Human Rights and Court of Human Rights. And you have then the courts in a situation where they would be reading into statute very broad implications that would create tremendous friction, severe friction for the United States foreign relations and for the executive branch in its management of foreign policy. So obviously our heart is always going to be with the plaintiffs in these cases, okay? We want to see them recover. We want to see some justice for them. But the question is, we also don't want to see the separation of powers here eroded, and we don't want to see cases where very important foreign relations interests are involved decided on the basis of broad readings of statutes that manage to increase those complications for the executive branch in its handling of foreign policy.
Now, that's very interesting, that separation of powers argument, because it's the common one used arguing in favor of comedy. Comedy being, I think, for everyone on the call who is likely aware of it, but it essentially a doctrine of abstention that in this case the court would exercise, even though it had jurisdiction, in order not to interrupt important sovereign considerations of the United States, generally expressed by the executive. And in fact, the State Department argued it in the oral arguments. But the respondents in the Simon case kind of turned that on their head and said, actually, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is an enactment by Congress that is meant to essentially eliminate comedy, which they, I think, even questioned the existence of as a doctrine. And maybe you could comment on that a little bit.
Yes.
And so therefore to reassert a notion of comedy here violates the separation of powers. And they sort of made a similar argument, maybe it was respondents in Philip did, in terms of the interpretational issues with regard to the taking exception. That this was in response to the notion that we're opening up our courts, that this was a decision that Congress had made. So they argued strongly that to overturn the case law would itself offend the separation of powers. What can you say on that?
Yeah, so I think the plaintiffs show rather convincingly that the doctrine of comedy goes all the way back to the famous case, the Belgenland in 1885, and they offered a number of other cases in 1932 and others that show the doctrine of comedy. And then, as I said, I mean, Justice Scalia, very much in his dissent in Hartford, the Hartford case, shows that comedy is a very, very appropriate doctrine in some cases. Now, the argument the plaintiffs were pushed here against the wall by a couple of the justices on the issue, okay, do you recognize comedy at all, or do you say it applies only occasionally? And when pressed they conceded that, well, sometimes it might apply, but only when the executive branch actually intervenes in the case. Now, that to me actually turns the FSIA on its head, because the purpose of the FSIA is to have the courts decide cases according to the law, not according to whatever the executive branch certifies in a particular case. And so here you would have the judges deciding that comity applies only when the executive branch thinks it should apply. And that to me is preposterous, you know. And the FSIA does not do away with comity, because the FSIA, again, is a jurisdictional statute that sets out various exceptions, okay? But they're all applied within the framework of the common law, that, you know, it does not say that these principles are thereby out of application. Judges still do what they normally do. The only difference is that it is all done by judges, and it is all done by judges in accordance with legal reasoning and legal principles. And when you look at legal reasoning and legal principles, the principles of comity, of form, and convenience retain their power within that framework. And the last thing you want is to have comity exercised only in cases where, you know, the executive branch steps in, because that, again, would defeat the whole purpose of the FSIA, which was to say, let's get the executive branch out of these kinds of determinations, leave it all to the judges, to the judiciary. Again, you know, in line with some very good separation of powers principles.
You know, just in stepping back for a minute to the issue of the taking and of the of whether it was in violation of international law, you pointed out that at the time the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act was passed, the United States had not acceded to the Convention on Genocide or Convention on Torture. There are a number of international conventions, but I don't understand you to be suggesting that genocide wasn't recognized. In fact, I think you said it was recognized as a under customary international law. And isn't that a flaw in the argument? Because what the respondents were arguing is that what the petitions were arguing is that it is in fact customary international law that should apply here, and that customary international law only extended to appropriation. But if we recognize that genocide is a crime under customary international law, and this is a taking in furtherance of genocide, it sort of is a counter argument to the notion that there's any restrictive reading here to expropriation.
Well, you could argue definitely, as I said, in the Hungarian case, this was a genocidal taking, okay? You could argue about whether the 1935 taking was a genocidal taking or simply a forced sale, okay? In other words, that the Nazis wanted this art collection because they wanted it, and they would have seized it from anybody regardless of whether they were Jewish or not. Now, they pushed the Jewish dealers to sell it. Was this already part of a genocidal campaign? I mean, obviously, Germany denied that it was a genocidal taking. It did not deny that it was a taking, but not that it was a genocidal taking, okay? But beyond that, the question is, shouldn't there still be room for the court to decide that comity here prevails? Yes, there was a taking. And in the case of Hungary, very clearly, I mean, Judge Katsas, in his dissent from the Court of Appeals decision, said, you know, no one is disputing that this was a genocidal taking. It was a genocidal taking. But doesn't the district court have the leeway to say, given the facts of the case, okay, this is a matter for comity. This is a matter for Hungary. Yes, we have jurisdiction, but we choose not to exercise it. Okay, we are on grounds of foreign nonconvenience and what they call, you know, non-exhaustion of domestic remedies. We are also exercise in comedy in this particular case. And you could say the same thing about Germany, that, okay, even if all the parties agree that, yes, this was a genocidal taking, that the court would have, okay, the grounds to apply notions of international comedy, and that international comedy grounds are even more relevant in the case of Germany, because Germany has made a very strong effort over the past few decades to settle these claims, you know, and there's a long history here of German courts and German bodies, you know, trying to settle these claims fairly, even though, you know, the first step with the commission did not work in favor of the plaintiffs, but allowing the German legal system to work its way. So, you know, that's kind of the fallback argument that the both Hungary and Germany made here.
Professor Cole, thank you. I've drawn you out longer than I intended to before getting to people who may be on the line with questions. So, Nick, I'd like to go to questions if there are some.
Yeah, great. So, and Jim, we don't have any questions lined up right now, but if we get one, I'll let you know. In the meantime, I'll send the floor back to you.
Thank you, and that's okay, because I have many. One is just sticking with the theme of comedy. I mean, I think petitioners, it was actually in the Philip case, because they made a comedy argument. There was a comedy argument in that case as well. I'm sorry, and the respondents in the Supreme Court, plaintiffs below, said, well, isn't the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act its own answer to comedy? Because what it does is recognized as a general principle immunity, and immunity is the highest form of comedy. And so all it does is carve out certain slight exceptions to that immunity. Why should comedy still exist? And I think the court took up this question. It was Justice Sotomayor, I think, who asked. You know, actually, it might have been, I think it was Justice Barrett. Are you arguing, is this an argument that FISA, the FSIA, obliterates the notion of comedy in the context of international claims for the taking of property?
Well, if you look at the statute as simply, you know, a jurisdictional statute, okay? So, yes, a U.S. federal district court has jurisdiction over the German case, has jurisdiction over the Hungarian case. There is no immunity. Okay, I can make a determination there is no immunity, and yet still exercise principles of comedy. I mean, I just don't see why comedy is irreversibly booted out of the legal analysis that a federal judge can engage in. And, you know, so we'll have to see how the Supreme Court resolves these cases. I mean, one good question is, you know, what standards might the court recognize as legitimate, as appropriate in a process of determining whether comedy can be used? Okay. Under what circumstances would comedy be acceptable, okay, for a federal judge to engage in? But again, as I said, yeah, you could say, yeah, we have jurisdiction, and yes, Germany, you're not immune. You know, for reasons of comedy, we choose to dismiss the case, okay?
You know, returning to the point raised by Justice Breyer and some of the other justices in this, and I think the also by Justice Gorsuch at one point and Justice Barrett, this notion of an onslaught of cases from around the world in U.S. courts and the subjection of the United States to similar litigation in other countries, which I guess, given that there's nothing like the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act elsewhere, would require those countries to enact some type of legislation to permit that. But you know, the examples were really legion. And if you think about it, if foreign nationals claiming against their own governments could bring suits for the deprivation of property in the course of a human right, violation of international law, you can imagine the Rohingya. You can imagine, I think Justice Breyer mentioned, victims of apartheid in South Africa. You can imagine, and this was a case that rejected this, victims of the military junta in Argentina seeking the 700 U.S. courts in the United States as a form in which to litigate those claims. But I guess the question I have based on that is, where was the rush of litigation after the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act was passed? Was there a rush of expropriation claims? Because certainly, you know, China, the Soviet Union, all of the countries of Eastern Europe at the time, and Cuba, and North Korea expropriated Western property and expropriated and so one would have expected this rush. Was there a rush?
Well, here's why there was no rush. Okay, so first of all, the United States, by executive agreement, recognized as legitimate by the Supreme Court of the United States at various points, settled our claims with Russia and with China. You know, a great loss to U.S. investors, I should add, you know, between 15 and 30 cents on the dollar. But those claims were settled, okay? And there were very specific agreements barring any kinds of claims. Another example is our peace treaty with Japan in 1951, very specifically barred any claims by Americans, including U.S. POWs, against Japan or Japanese companies or any harm suffered at the hands of Japan or Japanese companies. So a number of the most outstanding cases you could think of are barred by treaty. And this is why, you know, the FSIA does start out on Section 1604, you know, subject to existing international agreements to which the U.S. is a party at the time of the enactment of this act. And of course, a foreign state shall be immune. And this is, of course, the argument that Hungary used with regards to the 1947 Treaty of Peace, which the Court of Appeals chose to read as not really barring claims, okay, as not providing the sole mechanism. But in all these other cases, okay, China, Soviet Union, Vietnam, and Japan, okay, very clearly, the courts have said, you know, FSIA, you know, there's complete immunity because of these executive agreements or treaties. Okay, now, in the case of North Korea and Cuba, it's here are the facts. So, with regards to Cuba, the United States did pass the Helms-Burton Act, which by the way covered claims even by persons who were not U.S. citizens at the time of the taking. So that it covered takings by the Cuban government of Cuban property, okay? But it provided a waiver, okay? And all presidents, Democratic and Republican, exercised that waiver until President Trump a couple of years ago decided not to exercise that waiver anymore, okay? You know, in the case of North Korea, you know, they just wouldn't show up in court and they don't have any assets here anyway that one could recover against. So, you know, that's the reason we haven't seen that great rush of litigation.
Nick, I'm going to ask one more time if there's anyone in the waiting room waiting to ask a question. Otherwise, I'll go to a wrap-up question and we'll conclude this.
Yeah, go ahead to the wrap-up. We don't have anyone waiting right now.
So the wrap-up is very simple, Professor Cole. What should the court do in these two cases? And based on listening to the arguments on Monday, what do you think it will do?
Oh, my goodness.
Or what's your sense, at least,
yeah, I mean,
in terms of direction?
Said, you know, if you were to listen to the court's oral arguments closely, I just sensed a great deal of skepticism about the expansive implications of the readings of the FSIA given by the U.S. by the Circuit Court of Appeals, District of Columbia. Okay, I just sensed a great deal of skepticism as a whole on the part of all the justices to some degree. You know, as you pointed out, maybe less from Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor, but you know, not from the others. Okay, a lot of skepticism. So, you know, the court here could do any number of things. It could remand the case to the court below, or it could simply rule that comedy is applicable. And then, again, remand, you know, and then set out some standards, okay, for the application of comedy, and either determine that those standards apply or remand it to the court below, so as to ask the court below to apply those comedy standards, okay, in these two cases and see if they are sufficient, okay, to dismiss the claims.
So can it even reach the... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Can it even reach the comedy question if it doesn't grant jurisdiction?
Yeah, and I mean, the court could agree that there is jurisdiction, okay? The court could say that, yeah, there is jurisdiction, and that the question here is whether, in both cases, comedy should be exercised and can be exercised, and if so, what are the standards? I think this is one of the big issues that the court... I don't think the court is going to throw comedy out the window, okay? But the court is going to want to clarify the standards for the application of comedy. You know, comedy cannot just stay out there as this general doctrine. The court might want to clarify the standards for the application of comedy and then send the case back and say, okay, you apply these standards. And on the basis of these standards that we agree on, determine whether comedy does apply here. Okay. So that would be one way of that I could see the court deciding both of these cases. And of course, I could be totally wrong. But as I said, if they decide to affirm the District of Columbia Circuit, the court is going to have a lot of problems on its hands down the road, you know, and it's just difficult for me to see the justices in light of their own skeptical questioning being really eager to live with those problems.
That was my sense. It's always risky to count noses, but I counted, I think, at least five justices who were extremely skeptical of the notion that we should be admitting these cases into the United States. And the skepticism was on both sides of the traditional ideological divide. I actually found Justice Sotomayor to be one of the most skeptical. She really seemed to be signaling that and looking for, you know, what kind of relief, if any, the court should grant, assuming it didn't find jurisdiction here, not relief, but what kind of ruling it should make, what procedurally it should do. Justice Thomas was searching for procedural exits, and Justice Breyer, Kagan, Sotomayor, but also I think Kavanaugh and Gorsuch were skeptical of the claims of the degree to which this would open U.S. courts to an onslaught of claims. So you know, sometimes these foreign policy cases, and this is one, really produce some common ground in a way that others don't. I guess we'll have to see. But I'm indebted to you for your remarks today, Professor Cole, as is the Federalist Society and all of our listeners. And I thank you very much.
Jim, I am indebted to you for moderating and guiding and being a partner with me on this discussion. It's always a great honor to discuss these kinds of cases with our fellow members of Federalist Society. And I look forward to further conversations and discussions with you.
Well, thank you very much. And go ahead, Nick.
Sorry, I was just going to close out. Did you want to add anything?
No, I just wanted to say, and thank you, Nick.
Great. Thank you. And thank you both on behalf of the Federalist Society very much for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. Of course, to our audience for calling in. We welcome your feedback on these podcasts and others by email at info@fed-soc.org. We have a teleforum coming up in about a half hour here at the same number. We're covering Mnuchin v. Collins, a case heard oral arguments recently. And be keeping an eye on your emails and on our website for announcements about other upcoming teleforum calls. Thank you all for joining us this afternoon. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.